KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, what's behind the latest dispute between India and Pakistan and where it may be headed? Also, the Trump administration's efforts to take direct control of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and concerns over the effects. How tariffs may drive a rubber duck museum and gift shop to move across the border. And Dave Barry's new memoir, Class Clown.
In our house, the rule was that you could make fun of everything, and in fact, you should. You should never take anything too seriously, and above all, you should never take yourself too seriously.
But there have been dark passages. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, May 10, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. After days of heightened tensions, India and Pakistan agreed today to a ceasefire. NPR's Diya Hadid has been following the story from Mumbai.
President Trump had announced on his social media network that the two countries had agreed to a full and immediate ceasefire. And then India's Foreign Secretary Vikram Misri made a short announcement, and he said Pakistan's Director of Military Operations had called his Indian counterpart, and they agreed to this.
It was agreed between them that both sides would stop all firing and military action on land and in the air and sea with effect from 1700 hours Indian Standard Time today.
The neighbors had been exchanging airstrikes since an attack on tourists in the Indian-controlled section of Kashmir last month that killed 26 people. India said the group that claimed responsibility was a proxy for the Pakistani army. Pakistan denied any connection. Officials from the United States and China began trade talks in the Swiss city of Geneva this morning. This is the first time the two sides have sat down for in-person talks since President Trump raised tariffs on some Chinese goods to as high as 145%, leading Beijing to retaliate. Villa Marx reports.
After weeks of frazzled financial markets and sometimes angry rhetoric, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is meeting with Chinese Vice Premier He Lifeng beside Lake Geneva's sunny shoreline. Bessent said these talks came about almost by chance, since both countries' trade delegations were visiting this alpine nation known for its political neutrality. He said he hopes productive talks could prompt some de-escalation in a trade war that's seen billions of dollars worth of Chinese products prevented from entering the U.S. thanks to President Trump's prohibitively high import taxes. The Chinese say they expect to be treated with respect. Experts say a resolution could take months and many more rounds of talks like this. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx in Geneva.
Investors will be keeping an eye on the trade talks this weekend after stocks ended the week in the red following the Federal Reserve's decision to hold interest rates steady. NPR's Scott Horsley has more on the story.
President Trump floated the possibility of cutting the triple-digit tariff on Chinese imports, but the 80% import tax he suggested replacing it with would still be much higher than the U.S. has charged in the past. Investors were also disappointed by a tentative trade deal with the U.K. that would leave 10% tariffs on most British goods in place. The Federal Reserve warned on Wednesday that high tariffs increased the risk of pushing both inflation and unemployment up, so the central bank left its benchmark interest rate unchanged while waiting to see what happens. For the week, the Dow lost about 0.2%, the Nasdaq lost about 0.3%, and the S&P 500 index lost close to 0.5%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. An earthquake struck near Knoxville, Tennessee this morning. The U.S. Geological Survey put its preliminary magnitude at 4.1. Social media posts said the quake was felt in Atlanta, about 160 miles south. Georgia officials say it was the first quake felt there in years. The Catholic Church's new Pope, Leo XIV, held his first formal audience today. He signaled he intends to follow in his predecessor's footsteps, saying the late Pope Francis left a precious legacy that must be continued. NPR's Jason DeRose reports from Rome.
American cardinals who participated in the conclave this week say they're hoping the fact that Pope Leo is from the U.S. doesn't get in the way of Catholics viewing him as the leader of the whole church. Cardinal Robert McElroy, Archbishop of Washington, describes the experience of conclave as one of bringing unity.
All sense of those divisions within the world fell away, and I felt we were looking at that moment into the souls of one another.
McElroy hopes non-American and American Catholics alike can experience a similar profound sense of reconciliation, especially in a world so marked by war as well as political and religious tribalism. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Rome.
Cosmos returned to Earth today. The half-ton spacecraft was launched by the Soviet Union in 1972 on a mission to Venus. But a rocket failure kept it in low Earth orbit and has been sinking slowly since then. Russian space officials say it came down today in the Indian Ocean west of Jakarta. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. India and Pakistan have confirmed a ceasefire agreement today. President Trump announced the deal, and it follows a worrying series of escalating attacks that saw both countries target each other's military bases. The two nuclear rivals also exchanged shelling and gunfire for several days, much of it near what's called the line of control along the disputed region of Kashmir. Elizabeth Threlkeld is with the South Asian Program at the Stimson Center, a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank in Washington, D.C. She joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Do we know what role the U.S. played in this?
So based on tweets that are coming out from a variety of administration officials, it looks like the U.S. was heavily involved. President Trump, as you noted, announced this deal directly, saying it came after a long night of talks between both sides. We've also seen statements from Secretary Rubio, and it does look like that was in coordination with some partners in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, for example.
Remind us, Elizabeth, please, what started the fighting? And how did they find a way to declare this ceasefire?
Yeah, so that's actually a really interesting question, Scott. Of course, there is a long history here. Fundamentally, this goes back to the two sides' dispute over the Kashmir region, dating back to their partition in 1947. But over the past several decades, India in particular has accused Pakistan of sponsoring cross-border terrorism. And there was a serious attack that took place on April the 22nd, in which 26 predominantly Hindu tourists were killed in Indian-administered Kashmir. And over the past couple of weeks, tensions have escalated. We've seen diplomatic moves on both sides. And 4 days ago, a series of really significant military escalations began with Indian airstrikes in Pakistan and some retaliation, though we have to say at this point, even as we have a ceasefire, the fog of war is still pretty thick. And there's been a great deal of fake news on both sides. So, you know, for now, I think we should all be breathing a little bit easier that the ceasefire has happened. And, you know, this has been the most significant crisis we've seen between the two sides in at least 2.5 decades.
Is this a territorial conflict over Kashmir or something more?
It certainly speaks to that territorial conflict that is at the root of so much of this. But the two sides have really grown into a rivalry over the past 7+ decades that touches on a host of different issues. I think that the cross-border terrorism issue is one that is central in this. As I mentioned, India does accuse Pakistan of backing cross-border terrorism. But Pakistan, too, has raised accusations against India that India is sponsoring groups in Pakistan's western border region and carrying out assassinations. Obviously, perceptions matter in a crisis like this. And so as we look to what happens next, right, one of the interesting things out of Secretary Rubio's statement was a mention of talks on a broad set of issues at a neutral site. And so I think it's worth watching the extent to which we might be able to get into some of those issues in a way that we haven't in recent years.
As we mentioned earlier, these are two nuclear-armed states. And obviously this underscored the importance of trying to find an immediate resolution. Remind us of where India and Pakistan stand on their nuclear strategy, specifically in the right to strike first.
Yeah, so the two sides are different in some respects. India has a no first use doctrine, and Pakistan does not. It has a no first use doctrine. And one of the things that we see between the two sides is a pretty significant asymmetry in terms of their size, in terms of their budget, in terms of their conventional military capabilities. And so what has happened over time is Pakistan has developed its nuclear doctrine and posture to try to make up, to compensate for that asymmetry at the conventional level. And so with that, you know, there is a real risk here of nuclear escalation, especially when you have terror attacks leading to conventional conflict and a lot of misperception between the two sides without strong communication channels.
And you mentioned, of course, Secretary Rubio's tweet on broader issues that are up for negotiation. What do you foresee those issues might be?
So I think that is an open question and one that I certainly wouldn't want to prejudge. But here we do have some past precedent of looking back to previous rounds of talks the two sides have engaged in. Dating back to 1998 was really the start of a composite dialogue between the two sides just after they tested nuclear weapons. Over the years, we've seen on-again, off-again talks that unfortunately in many times have been punctuated and stalled by spoiler attacks. And so I think the challenge now, if we are to get into some of these deeper issues, things like terrorism accusations, things like Kashmir, the trick will be to do so in such a way that we do not get into this sort of crisis again going forward so that it doesn't become a precedent.
Elizabeth Threlkeld of the Stimson Center, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
NPR has learned that the Trump administration has tightened its control over the independent agency that regulates America's nuclear reactors. Some nuclear experts worry that the changes could put safety at risk and even more upheaval could be ahead. We're joined now by NPR science correspondent Jeff Brumfield. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
This agency, of course, known as the NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, what's changing?
So the NRC was set up back in 1974 by Congress as an independent agency, and it's operated under the purview of five commissioners, a mix of Democrats and Republicans. And their job is to enforce the rules of the nation's nuclear reactors. But now the White House is getting involved. Two U.S. officials tell NPR that any new rules for nuclear safety must now go through the White House Office of Management and Budget for review before they can be finalized. And the White House also reserves the right to change those nuclear safety rules if they see fit. This is a big departure. I spoke to a former chair of the NRC, Allison McFarland. She was appointed by President Obama, and here's what she had to say.
It's absolutely essential that the nuclear regulator be independent. And what does that mean? It means independent of political and industry influence.
She felt this kind of review should be off limits.
Sounds like even more changes might be coming, too, I gather. You've seen a draft of an executive order that President Trump may sign regarding the NRC. What does that say?
Yeah, that's right. This executive order is entitled, quote, Ordering Reform of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It calls for a reduction in force at the NRC, a, quote, wholesale revision of nuclear safety regulations. speeding up review of licenses for new kinds of reactors. And lastly, it instructs the agency to look into relaxing some of the radiation standards for workers and the public. Of course, this is a draft. We don't know what will be in the final version, or even if Trump will sign a final version, but he is expected to sign some orders related to nuclear power relatively soon.
Jeff, why does the administration seem so eager to get involved with nuclear safety?
You know, Scott, it's less about safety and more about independence. The administration really doesn't like independent agencies. It views them as bureaucracy run amok. Here's Russ Vogt, Trump's head of the Office of Management and Budget, speaking about it to Tucker Carlson.
There are no independent agencies. Congress may have viewed them as such, but as an administration, the whole notion of an independent agency should be thrown out.
And the White House echoed that sentiment in a statement for this story. They said, quote, the president of the United States is head of the executive branch, and then went on to say that it was he who was in charge of agencies like the NRC. Now, I should say the NRC has a reputation for being hidebound and extremely strict. And in fact, Congress passed legislation last year to try to reform its regulatory process. But even critics of the agency said they really doubted the White House getting involved would help. For one thing, it'll just add another layer of bureaucracy when trying to deal with new regulations.
Certainly, a lot of people would be concerned about whether these changes could somehow help make a nuclear emergency more likely.
Yeah, well, McFarland, the former NRC chair, told me she did think this would impact safety.
If you aren't independent of political and industry influence, then you are at risk of an accident, frankly.
But at the same time, the NRC is maintaining very high existing standards at nuclear plants, and the industry has a decent safety track record. I really think this is more about what safety might look like 5 or 10 years down the road.
NPR's Jeff Brumfield, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And as part of those efforts focused on federal agencies, the Trump administration has slashed AmeriCorps, which pairs Americans with volunteer opportunities in communities across the country.
I still want to do like community work, like government or community, but they get paid by the AmeriCorps, and I am in limbo right now trying to find a job.
We hear from recently cut volunteers and how they are coping later today on All Things Considered. You can tune in by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or to play your member station by name. You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Representatives from the U.S. and China are holding talks in Switzerland today on how to de-escalate tensions on trade. The world's two biggest economies have imposed hefty tariffs on each other's goods that have disrupted the global economy. India and Pakistan agreed to a ceasefire today after days of heightened tensions. The neighbors had attacked each other after gunmen fired on tourists in a meadow in Kashmir last month, killing 26 people. And Pope Leo held his first formal audience today. Speaking to the cardinals who elected him this week, he said he'll continue the work of Pope Francis, an attempt to make the Catholic Church more inclusive. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. NPR has learned that the Department of Agriculture is demanding sensitive data from states about millions of people who receive food assistance. This comes as the Ad Hoc Department of Government Efficiency is amassing data for immigration enforcement. We're joined now by Jude Joffe Block from NPR's Power and Influence team. Jude, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
What kind of data is the USDA asking for?
Yeah, so there are more than 40 million people who get food assistance every month, and the program is known as SNAP, and the data is with the states. That's how it's always been. But last week, the department told all states, as well as the companies that process payments, they have to hand over data like names, dates of birth, addresses, and social security numbers of all SNAP participants going back 5 years to January 2020, which is a lot of people and a lot of sensitive data. And our reporting found out that even before this directive came out, the agency's Office of Inspector General was trying to get even more expansive data on SNAP recipients from the country's biggest states, including at least in one state, citizenship status.
How could this data foster the administration's efforts to deport people who are in the country illegally?
We still don't know how the data could be used. Last week's letter said it was to ensure program integrity and verify the eligibility of benefit recipients. But several news outlets have now reported that the DOGE team has been combining various federal databases in an effort to build up a tool to track and arrest immigrants. And where this data fits in, you know, it could be another piece of the puzzle as it includes recent addresses. Even though immigrants who are in the country without legal status don't qualify for SNAP benefits, there are people in SNAP's data sets that could be subject to deportation now or in the future, or share a household with someone in that situation. For example, if U.S. citizen children are eligible for food assistance, their parents can sign them up, regardless of the parents' immigration status. You know, we didn't hear back from DOGE and the White House on this, though.
And Jude, isn't access to sensitive personal information one of the big legal hurdles that this administration keeps running into?
Yeah, there are more than a dozen federal lawsuits at this point that allege DOGE staffers have been illegally granted permission to view databases with personal and financial information that the government maintains. You know, multiple federal judges have expressed concern about what information DOGE has accessed and why. You know, we spoke with John Davison. He's an attorney at the nonprofit Electronic Privacy Information Center. He had this to say about the latest demand for SNAP data.
It is absolutely alarming from a privacy perspective. It's reckless. It is an unprecedented extension of the administration's campaign to consolidate personal data.
His position is that this data request likely violates the Privacy Act, though the USDA told us the request will comply with privacy laws and will follow responsible data handling requirements.
Where do things go from here, Jude? Does the federal government access to this data right now?
The states are still trying to figure out how to respond to these requests, and it could wind up, like a lot of things these days, in the courts. As for what to expect next, we know Republicans in Congress are teeing up a proposal to make deep cuts to SNAP, the food assistance program. And we've seen this play out where federal data is used by DOGE to make exaggerated allegations of waste and fraud to justify slashing government programs.
NPR's Jude Joffe-Block, who reported this story, with NPR's Stephen Fowler. And you can read a fuller version of their story on NPR.org. Jude, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mark Carney, the new Canadian Prime Minister, had a friendly Oval Office meeting earlier this week with President Trump. But the tariffs President Trump began and to which Canada replied in kind are still in effect. Tariffs and anti-American feelings are bruising U.S. businesses that once attracted Canadian shoppers across the border for cheap gas and food. Neil and Crystal King run a novelty shop in Point Roberts, Washington State, that caters to Canadian tourists. They also own the Rubber Duck Museum, but say that soon they will move to Canada. Neil and Crystal King join us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us today.
Look, we'll get into tariffs and international relations, but why is there a Rubber Duck Museum?
Crystal, you got this one.
Yeah, okay. Our town is an exclave. It is attached to Canada, not the U.S. mainland. Which makes us obviously very dependent on Canadian tourism for the economy. And since the pandemic border closures, the town's really been struggling to bring tourism back up. So we wanted to bring in an exhibit that would help attract people here. We'd already had several hundred rubber ducks in the store. And so we decided to lean into that. We discovered there has never been a just rubber duck museum. And thought that would be a fun venture.
Forgive my ignorance. Is there like a Mona Lisa of rubber ducks that you have or something of particular historic note?
One of my favorites is we have a old school rubber duck from the 1930s that was produced by Sieberling and Disney. And we also have the mold that created it. So it was just, it's so cool and so neat to have.
I can't believe I've gotten to this point in my life and not seen it. do tell us about Point Roberts. What's it like now with this current tension?
Quiet.
Yeah,
that's the best way to kind of describe it. You can feel it in the air. It's just quiet. There's no cars on the street right now. And even during Easter weekend, it just felt empty. And usually during those three-day weekends, our town is just bustling.
What's the reason? What do customers tell you, friends?
We've had a lot of regulars and loyal customers reach out to us throughout this whole thing the last couple of months, and they're pretty much all saying the exact same thing. They feel very offended by a lot of the rhetoric coming out of the White House right now. They don't like their sovereignty being threatened. They feel like the only tool they have is boycotting the United States and keeping those tourist dollars out of here.
You're moving?
We're not moving our home yet. We're really hoping to stay in Point Roberts. But the rubber ducks have to move.
And I realize they may not have a voice in this, but why do the rubber ducks have to move?
Pretty much overnight, the entire business model became unsustainable. Nobody is making rubber ducks outside of China. And so all at once, every single product that we bring in for the museum became more expensive for us. We can't get rubber ducks in anymore for a price point that makes any kind of sense for anybody.
But this is a big move. I mean, what if suddenly next week the tariffs are rescinded?
Yeah, it's just the instability of, you know, waking up every day and going, is it a tariff day or not, just isn't a sustainable business model for any small business, let alone a small business that is reliant on Canadian tourism.
And China manufacturing.
Will you lose some of the charm by not being in Point Roberts?
Oh, absolutely. it's not the step we wanted to take, honestly. We love having our quaint little shop here. It means so much to us. We've been invested in staying here, but it's not a choice between moving the ducks to Canada or keeping them here. It's a choice between moving to Canada or closing.
Crystal King and Neil King run the Rubber Duck Museum that for the moment is in Port Roberts, Washington. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now it's time for sports. NBA playoffs, champs on the ropes, NHL playoffs, making Canadian teams great again. And Da Pope, Michelle Steele of ESPN joins us. Michelle, thanks for being with us.
A blessed good morning to you, Scott.
A blessed good morning to you, too, my fellow Chicagoan. Let's begin with basketball. The top seeds in both conferences are down in the second round of the playoffs. In the West, the Oklahoma City Thunder lost to the Nuggets in overtime last night. They're down 2-1. In the East, the Cleveland Cavaliers, you know I've got another Cleveland Rocks, won last night, but still trail the Indiana Pacers 2-1. And even the defending champ, Boston Celtics, are down 2-0 against the New York Mets, game 3 this afternoon. Are the Celtics just out of luck this year?
They might be, Scott. You know, not only was Boston favored in this series, but the Seas have squandered 20-point leads in both games, and now they are perilously close to going down 3-0 in this series. Now, Weekend Edition is on the case, Scott. I have made some calls to people who should know around the Celtics team, and I can report even they don't know what's going on with the defending champs. You know, Kristaps Porzingis, their big man, has been dealing with the virus. But the biggest thing is you got to have your big-time players step up when it counts, and Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown just aren't dominating.
Stanley Cup, eight teams remain. The quest for a Canadian champion.
Oh, yeah.
Seems to be going well. The Maple Leafs and the Edmonton Oilers lead their series. Seem to be hitting stride at just the right moment, don't they?
I'll say, and Winnipeg just shut out Dallas last night. We've got three Canadian teams in the second round of the NHL playoffs. For the first time since 2004, the Oilers play the Golden Knights in Vegas tonight. We've talked about that 30-plus year Canadian Stanley Cup drought, Scott. Maybe this is a year a lot of Canadians would love to see it.
I got to ask about Bill Belichick. He hadn't even coached a game in his new gig at North Carolina. And now maybe the greatest football coach of all time, who's famous for keeping distractions away from his team, has run into a big one, hasn't he?
Yeah, and she's got a name, Jordan Hudson. 73-year-old Bill Belichick's 24-year-old girlfriend, who appears to be kind of like managing his affairs, you know, with UNC and with the press. And, you know, we don't get into personal lives too much on this segment, but a clip from CBS News went viral where he was asked how they met, and his girlfriend jumped in off camera and said, "We're not talking about that. UNC is paying the six-time Super Bowl winning coach $10 million a year, Scott. He's the highest paid state employee. They don't want to see this PR mess." My friend Pablo Torre reported this week, among many other details, that Belichick's family now is very concerned about the damage being done to his reputation. You know, I covered Bill for 3 years.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe that someone who was so controlled is at the center of a drama like this.
And, of course, the school went back and forth about whether or not Jordan was welcome on campus.
Yeah, but if you read the language of their letter, their statement to the press, they're very careful to refer to her as a non-employee. And non-employees, sure, they can come into the building, but it also leaves open the door that they likely told her, you know, you can't really be involved with the football stuff anymore.
And finally, on Thursday, a short but sacred controversy. Is Pope Leo a Cubs or a White Sox fan? Local news on the case. Here's John Prevost, Pope Leo's brother, clearing things up with WGN.
He was never, ever a Cubs fan, so I don't know where that came from. He was always a Sox fan.
Michelle, what's it like to be there this past week?
Scott, I was watching TV this morning, and the anchor said, White Sox Nation is celebrating the ascension of one of their own to the papacy. That is an amazing sentence, Scott. The last 48 hours have been bonkers. The whole city is just captivated by a Southsider becoming Pope. But I think, you know, the biggest thing for me is that his fandom makes him so instantly relatable. You know, for the first time in 2,000 years, we've got a Pope who knows that White Sox first baseman Paul Konerko hit a legendary grand slam in the 2005 World Series.
Yeah, he was there. I've seen pictures of him.
He was there. You know, back then he was Father Bob. He was in the stands for that World Series run. He's a true fan just like us. I think the picture had him on his phone. Yeah. So I'm assuming Scotty was making a call upstairs, you know?
He doesn't need a phone for that, but I take your, your observation.
The White Sox will take the prayers. Let's just say that.
They could use them. Listen, I've got to try this out. Go, Pope, go. Go, Pope, go. Hey, Chicago, what do you say? The Pope is on his way today.
Holy cow, Scott.
Michelle Steele of ESPN, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. A remarkable week for the Catholic Church. Cardinals meeting at the Vatican elected a new pope, and he's from the U.S., specifically Chicago. Pope Leo XIV, formerly Cardinal Robert Prevost. And now some of the other U.S. cardinals who voted in the conclave are talking about the election. Joining us from home is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Jason, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
And how are U.S. cardinals responding to, if I might put it this way, another American being Pope?
Well, they're downplaying the fact that he is an American. Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, the Archbishop Emeritus of Galveston, Houston, put it this way.
He's really a citizen of the entire world since he has spent so much of his life, ministry, missionary work, and zeal for Christ in South America.
And Leo really does have an international resume, ministry in Peru as a pastor, bishop, and archbishop, and at the Vatican in high-level church administration. But then Cardinal Timothy Dolan, Archbishop of New York, had a more spiritual take on where the Pope is from.
He reminds us that we all have our true citizenship in heaven, as St. Paul taught us, and that is his role as universal pastor. Where he comes from is sort of now a thing of the past.
And he makes the point that Cardinal Prevost was a son of Chicago, but Pope Leo is a leader for every Catholic everywhere.
And Jason, how are U.S. cardinals talking about what it was like in the conclave?
Well, I think it's important for secular society to understand that this is far more than a political election for cardinals, though we sometimes talk about it that way, right? Who's up? Who's down? Who's the front runner? Joseph Cardinal Tobin of Newark says the electors were focused on more profound questions than who and from where.
What does the church need? What's the world need? What are we hoping for? What are we dreaming about? So a starkness followed by expectation.
And Jason, is there a sense among the U.S. cardinals that expectations were met?
Met and exceeded, Scott, and not just for the church with all its problems, right? Financial problems, sex abuse, falling numbers, internal tensions over doctrine. Cardinal Blaise Supich of Chicago described the experience as raising expectations beyond the church.
I hope that's a signal to the world that we can reach across our differences in culture, language, country, nationality, and work together to solve the problems that are there. That we have the opportunity to reconcile and have peace.
And understanding, Scott, that the church exists for the life of the world.
Finally, Jason, did you have a sense that these U.S. cardinals will feel a special connection to the Pope from America?
Well, I think just as special a connection as any cardinal feels to the Pope, but certainly one informed by common experiences, especially the common experience of having been raised Catholic in America. And Catholic in America, given the age of many of the cardinals, when that was perhaps something suspicious or even not fully American. Here's how Cardinal Wilton Gregory, Archbishop Emeritus of Washington, described that relationship.
I felt comfortable saying to Pope Leo, from one south sider of Chicago to another, I promise you my respect, my fidelity, and my love.
A respect, fidelity, and love, Scott, that many, many Catholics feel toward the Pope, whether from the U.S. or from elsewhere.
NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose in Rome. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
Multi-level marketing companies recruit salespeople with a message of abundant profit. But salespeople have to buy their products up front.
When companies do reveal the earnings statistics for how much people can actually make in this kind of side hustle, it's devastatingly low.
Bridget Reed on MLMs and her new book, Little Bosses Everywhere, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The leaders of France, Germany, Poland, and the United Kingdom are in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, today to show support for Ukraine's battle against Russia. They called for an unconditional 30-day ceasefire to begin Monday. A federal judge has ordered the Trump administration pause its large-scale downsizing of the federal government. Judge Susan Elston of San Francisco said it had failed to get congressional approval for the cuts as required by the Constitution. And an earthquake with a magnitude of 4.1 hit near Knoxville, Tennessee today. It could be felt in Atlanta, Georgia, about 160 miles away. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. 11,000 Veterans Affairs employees are looking to leave the agency, many of them frontline medical staff. That is according to data that VA staff have shared with NPR, and it comes as the Trump administration seeks to cut 15% of the agency's workforce. Now the VA says not so fast. Katya Mendoza with Arizona Public Media has more.
Veterans Affairs is the second largest department in the federal government, right after the Pentagon. About 470,000 people work for the VA, and all but about 100,000 are healthcare professionals. In a recent visit to Tucson, VA Secretary Doug Collins said the department is looking at positions where cuts should be made.
We have too many people in our organization that don't actually touch a veteran, do not actually participate in the actual care of how we deliver it to a veteran themselves here at this hospital or in the disability claims.
But the VA is allowing all employees to volunteer for deferred resignation or take early retirement. According to an agency dashboard that VA employees have shared with NPR, about 2,400 medical staff, including nurses and social workers, are volunteering to leave.
A lot of veterans are calling us and they're worried because they're afraid that this is going to affect their health care, this is going to affect their benefits.
Dan Clare is with the Veterans Service Organization, Disabled American Veterans.
We're not getting the answers to who is being cut, what jobs are going away, how's that going to affect veterans.
In a statement, VA Press Secretary Pete Kasperowitz told NPR the agency will be very careful in allowing medical staff to take the administration's deferred resignation offer. The statement says, quote, "Approval for staff in these positions requires multiple high-level reviews, and VA anticipates very few of these applications to be approved." At a contentious hearing this week, Secretary Collins accused Democratic members of Congress of trying to scare veterans and his employees by saying his agency is eliminating medical staff. A VA employee who requested anonymity for fear of retribution told NPR that stress related to uncertainty about their jobs is already starting to indirectly affect patient care. For NPR News, I'm Katia Mendoza in Tucson.
John Adams has written operas that spring from world events. Nixon in China, The Death of Klinghoffer, Dr. Atomic. But the great composer's newest work, premiering at the Metropolitan Opera, is his first adaptation of a play by Shakespeare. Jeff London reports.
John Adams says he's always loved Shakespeare, in particular the tragedy Antony and Cleopatra.
I think what I loved about it is the fact that Antony and Cleopatra are not Romeo and Juliet. They're not young lovers. They're people who've been around the block. Each one has a checkered past.
That I may sleep out this great gap of time, my Antony is away. Think of him too much.
But adapting this huge historical drama, which takes place in Egypt and across the Roman Empire, required some judicious trimming.
At times I've called it a big mess. 50 characters, 30 scenes, 3 continents, all kinds of history kind of into this big bouillabaisse. And obviously, you can't do it all.
So Adams turned to director Elkanah Pulitzer, who, with a dramaturg, helped him shape the libretto. Much has been cut, some things have been added, but the focus rests squarely on the fall of Antony and Cleopatra and the rise of young Octavius Caesar. Pulitzer says,
there's some big, huge stakes, but it's also sort of lifestyles of the rich and famous, people behaving badly in their, relationships with one another. And so there's this toggle between public and private. They're sort of iconic public figures. And then also, by contrast, see what it's like when they're just being messy human beings.
And playing these messy human beings are veterans of previous John Adams operas. Gerald Finley as Antony and Julia Bullock as Cleopatra.
There's some really surprising music from Cleopatra, these violent outbursts of hers that are very exciting musically, pretty pointillistic also. I think some of John's most pointillistic writing.
Upon the getting of a lawful ring, and by a gem of a woman, to be abused by one who looks on fetus.
In fact, given both the fighting and the passion between the two lovers, the production hired not just a fight director, but an intimacy coordinator to help the singers negotiate the physical and emotional aspects of performing the opera, says Gerald Finley.
The idea is to coordinate it so that it's very, very well managed, but then has the possibility of being released in the moment in the actual performances, because, as we say, we built this trust.
They're really sexy, and they really just tear into each other when they have an argument.
John Adams says one reason Bullock and Finley are so effective in their roles is that he wrote the music specifically for the two of them.
I always compose with the performer in mind, so part of it was just letting it rip, their personalities.
Still, the composer says his favorite moment in the opera is much quieter. It comes when Antony is dying from his own self-inflicted wound and is together with Cleopatra for one final moment.
He's weak and he's just about ready to fade away, but that's the moment when they really realize they love each other, and it's very tender.
Seek your honor with
for safety.
They do not fall together.
Oh, I can no more.
I have always felt that music is the most psychologically precise of all the arts. Part of composing is creating an alchemy between the colors and the gestures of the orchestra and the beauty of the voice. And of course, in this case, I've got Shakespeare's language, which is incomparably wonderful.
Antony and Cleopatra opens at the Metropolitan Opera on Monday evening. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Sometimes the title does tell it all, and even maybe a little too much. Dave Barry's new book is Class Clown, The Memoirs of a Professional Wiseass. How I Went 77 Years Without Growing Up. Dave Barry wrote a syndicated humor column for 22 years. He won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary. And like his many books, Class Clown is funny, and that makes some of the recollections that are darkest and probably hardest stand out, and we will alert you that there may be mention of suicide. Dave Barry joins us now from Coral Gables, Florida. Dave, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Class Clown, that's an official title you were bestowed once, wasn't it?
I actually won the title, well, the male title. It was male and female back then. Of Class Clown, Pleasantville High School, Pleasantville, New York, class of 1965. It was a fair election, too. No matter what you hear, no matter what people say.
We've got complaints, as you can imagine. We hear from them every week. Some people have never accepted that. How did you learn you could make people laugh?
Well, you want to say that it's natural, that it, you know, some people are funny, some people are not. But I really had a pretty good mentor in my mom. Both my parents were funny people. My mom was different. She was very, very dark. She, in fact, had a depressive personality, which she battled all her life. Yeah. But she was really, really edgy and really, really funny in a way that made her quite different from anybody else I knew, especially any mom I knew back in the 50s when, you know, she was raising us four kids. So in our house, the sort of the rule was that you could make fun of everything. And in fact, you should. You should never take anything too seriously, and above all, you should never take yourself too seriously.
Yeah. Could you tell us about the fruitcake?
Yeah, yes, I will. Every year in our house, a little house in Armonk, New York, we would get from a neighbor a fruitcake as a Christmas gift. And we hated it. And so my mom and I developed a tradition, which is the fruitcake would come. And she'd say, "Oh, Davy, the fruitcake is here." And I'd go, "Oh, hurrah. I hope we don't leave it in the doorway again." And mom would open the kitchen door and put the fruitcake down. And then she'd go, "I'm feeling a draft. I'd best close the door." And she would slam the door on the fruitcake. And then we would lament that the fruitcake was no longer edible and we would have to throw it away. And we did that every year. And it was my favorite Christmas tradition. Maybe still is.
Your father, Presbyterian minister, ran a relief society in New York. You call him the best man you ever knew. People would call him at home for help.
Yeah, my dad was just a naturally sympathetic person, great listener, non-judgmental guy. And he didn't have a congregation. He ran a social work agency called the New York City Mission Society in New York City. He was very active in anti-poverty work and civil rights movement. But people just trusted my dad, loved my dad, and would come to him all hours of the day, night. He would be on the phone all the time and counseling people, helping people. He was just a good person.
Your father developed a problem at some point, didn't he?
Yes. My dad, he fell deeply into alcoholism in his late 40s, early 50s, and it got worse and worse. And he was so loved that people kind of propped him up, but it just got bad. And ultimately, it got so bad that he bottomed out, which was fortunate for him. And in his late 50s, he got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And because he was the kind of guy he was, he didn't just go through the program and recover, and he never drank again. But he became extremely active in AA and helped set up AA programs in the New York State prison system. He ended up turning, as he so often did, turning a rough thing into a good thing.
And your mother, this sharp, funny, profane, and a creative woman, went into a tailspin, didn't she?
She did. After my dad died, she'd always fought with depression. We always knew that. You know, there would be days when, she was just really barely there. And there were several rough years there where she basically bounced around the country between me and my two brothers, yeah, looking for a place to live. And ultimately, she committed suicide, which came as a shock when it happened, but not really a surprise. I went through this phase. I think a lot of people, when they're, you know, I was in my 40s. I was a father. I had a career. My mom was getting older. And you get through this phase where you think you know more than your parents. I thought I knew what mom needed to do. I would tell her, Mom, you got to snap out of this. You got to pick a place to live. You make friends. You've got friends. And I was an idiot. I mean, I didn't know what she was going through and still feel guilty about that. When she was really struggling, I was telling her what to do instead of maybe listening more to what she was dealing with. Not that I don't know that it would have stopped it, but might have.
Dave, I say this as someone, suicide has run in our family too. I think your mother didn't want to trouble you.
Yeah, that is so true. She was the depression era mom who never wanted to be a burden to anybody. And in fact, before she took her life, she sent birthday cards to all of us, telling us how much she loved us. You know, it wasn't our birthdays. Why didn't I see that signal? But you're absolutely right. She didn't want to be a burden. And that was her way of relieving us of that.
Well, let me also ask about...
Boy, we're making this book sound pretty fun, huh, Scott?
Well, but you know it is, and this is life.
Yeah, yeah. And I didn't want to skip over where I came from. People always ask you, where do you get your ideas? You know, and I wanted to go into the, like, well, part of where I got them was my childhood, which was actually a wonderful childhood, but it had, yeah, you know, this element.
How does it feel to have a sewage pumping station named after you?
It's a great honor. And I mean, I know you talk to a lot of writers, a lot of great writers, but how many of them do have a sewage lifting station named after them? I do. I wrote a column making fun of North Dakota, which is a mistake I will never make again.
Oh, now that you're part of it, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I got invited to Grand Forks, North Dakota in January when it was like 40 below zero, and they dedicated a sewage lifting station in my honor, and it's still there. You can go there and see a Dave Barry lift station number. I think it's number 16, something like that. Every now and then, it's quite infrequent, but I will get a picture someone took standing in front of my lift station in Grand Forks, North Dakota.
You do have some concerns about what's happening to humor these days.
Yeah, I do. And this is maybe just old guy things. I'm 77, and when I got started in the humor biz, the big humorists were like people like Russell Baker or Art Buchwald, Johnny Carson on TV. And there was a certain generosity of spirit about it. People made fun of everything. You know, whoever was the president, yeah, you made fun of that person. And Carson made fun and everybody just laughed and went on with it. And the people he was making fun of laughed with him half the time. And I'm not going to put blame on anybody in particular, okay? But I am going to say we just aren't there anymore. Now you kind of have to pick a side in humor. And if you make fun of one side, the other side will hate you. And you're evil and stupid and vice versa. But it's sad to me that we can't laugh together the way we used to laugh together. Maybe that's very naive to say. I guess it sounds that way. But I still find it sad.
Dave Barry, his new memoir, Class Clown. Thank you so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure, always is.
Thank you for listening today. And for anybody in crisis, you can call or text 988 for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
FiberPlus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
I got rhythm, I got music, I got my man, who could ask for anything more? I got daisies in green pastures, I got my man, who could ask for anything more? Old Man Trouble, I don't mind him, you won't find him round my door. I got starlight, I got sweet dreams, I got my man, who could ask for anything more? Who could ask for anything more? Days can be sunny.